Today on the 21st, Natasha Trethewey's poems tell the stories of forgotten people. We'll talk with the former Poet Laureate of the United States about how poetry can help Americans better understand each other.
You know, some of the things that I say may sound incendiary to someone, but it's very different if you hear it in a poem. Because that is, you know, the intimate nature of the soul trying to communicate with someone else's soul.
Plus, we'll learn about what went wrong in the now infamous United Airlines passenger removal incident with Chicago Sun-Times columnist Mark Brown and the University of Illinois Police Training Director Michael Schlosser. What are aviation police trained to do at O'Hare? And how should a trained police officer respond in this type of situation? That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You probably heard the details about this incident with United Airlines, but in case you didn't, on Sunday, 69-year-old David Dow was told to get off a United Airlines flight from Chicago to Louisville to make room for airline crew members. When he refused, aviation police violently dragged him off the plane. There were some videos showing him with blood on his face. It's gone viral. Lots of people have been talking about it, including our congressional delegation here in Illinois has weighed in. Representative Jan Schakowsky has proposed a law that would ban airlines from removing passengers against their will. Senators Durbin and Duckworth have also raised questions about the incident, including whether taxpayer-funded law enforcement can be used to remove paying passengers for non-security reasons. Today, we wanted to talk about the fact that all of this happened under the watch of aviation police officers. They are different from regular law enforcement. And we wanted to ask a question. What are aviation police officers trained to do at O'Hare? And how should a trained police officer have responded in that kind of situation? As always, you're welcome to join our conversation. You can tweet to 21STShow your thoughts on this incident. You can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Joining us to talk about this is Michael Schlosser. He's director of the University of Illinois Police Training Institute. On the line from Chicago is Sun-Times columnist Mark Brown, who wrote an interesting column this week about guns and aviation officers at O'Hare. We're going to tweet out that link right now so you can see it as well. It's 21STShow's our handle. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me here on the 21st.
Good morning.
Thank you, Nyla. Morning.
Morning. Mark, let's start with you. How are aviation police different from, say, CPD or even the TSA for that matter?
Well, the Chicago aviation officers, and I imagine this is different in, you know, whatever jurisdiction you'd have, but here in the city, they're not members of the Chicago Police Department. Let's start there. So they don't get paid as much, but they get paid pretty well. They do go through the Chicago Police Academy, but they don't get as much training as a Chicago police officer would. But it is as much training as it would allow them to work on a suburban police department, for instance, with the same amount of training.
Okay, so they're more it sounds like they're more than private security, but they're not as much as CPD law enforcement, for example.
That's true. Basically, they started 30 years ago as an upgrade over private security. It was at a time, of course, that, you know, they're starting to realize, hey, we need better security at the airport, but we don't want to pay to have a lot of fully trained police out there because that's going to cost a lot of money. And quite honestly, there just is not a whole lot of policing to do out at the airport. It's a place where the senior police officers go to, finish out their careers because, you know, you're not expecting a lot of action out there. Although, obviously, you can get big action, but as a rule, you don't.
Right.
So,
Mike, go ahead, Mark. Go ahead.
And then there's this issue of, from the start, there's been this issue of, well, should these guys be allowed to carry guns? And, you know,
they're not, correct?
They are not allowed to carry guns and never have been. And all along they've, you know, that's a point of contention, always been a point of contention with them. You know, a police officer, I guess, feels naked without a gun. And these guys want to be able to carry a gun. And
thanks for that, Mark. Yeah, Mike, can I ask you to, so Mark made an interesting distinction. He said they get as much training as a suburban police officer, but not as much as a City of Chicago police officer. You're the director of the University of Illinois, the Police Training Institute at the University of Illinois. Mike, what does that mean? How much training do police, I know it obviously varies, but what kind of training do police officers get that would be different from suburban or maybe a smaller city across Illinois as opposed to Chicago CPD or the Chicago Police Department?
Well, the Chicago PD is at a place where they can give that extra training to their police officers. The Illinois Law Enforcement Training and Standards Board requires the 12-week academy for municipal and suburban city police officers to go through to get certified as a police officer, and they that they have that same certification with the same policing powers, and they are they can carry weapons if that is allowed. I don't know if that answered your question.
I think it did. Okay. So it's, the minimum is 12 weeks, is what you're saying.
Yes,
and
that's getting ready to change to 14 weeks here this summer.
So this summer it will go to 14 weeks for everyone. Even and would the aviation folks be included in that 14 weeks then as well?
I'm not sure what their training is because
yeah.
we don't train them.
So. And Mark, what's their jurisdiction, right? Because you wrote about this in your column on Monday. 3 decades ago, then Mayor Daley turned O'Hare Security Guard into their own police force within the aviation department. Is that who oversees them? Why did Mayor Daley do that?
They're overseen by the aviation department. He did that because they needed to beef up security without giving those without going to the expense of Chicago police officers are pretty well paid and have good benefits and pensions and everything, right? So you didn't want to have that cost, but you wanted a little bit more professionalism that you controlled. In fact, many of these guys are actually retired Chicago police officers drawing a pension and a salary at the same time. So their jurisdiction is within the sort of the inside of the airport. As I understand it, they don't man a point, like a checkpoint to get inside the airport, but they're checking. There's a lot of places inside the airport, within the bounds of the airport, where, you've got to kind of keep an eye on the employees.
Right. And there are CPD does have a presence at O'Hare as well. So there are Chicago police officers
yes.
who
CPD
also have a detail
at the
there.
Airport.
Right.
TSA is at the airport. And there also is, I think they say there's four levels of security. And the fourth level is private security. Again, unarmed, they also wish they had some weapons, too.
Okay. So, Michael, I wonder...
They're not qualified.
They're not qualified. Okay. And we're going to get to the gun situation in a minute. But, Mike, I want to just ask you, you and I have talked many times about de-escalation and the de-escalation tactics that you teach at the Police Training Institute. Can I just sort of ask you what your initial reaction was when you saw the video, when you've seen, well, there's a couple videos, when you heard about the incident? What was your initial reaction as someone who trains police officers to hopefully not have a situation like this?
Yeah, without knowing everything,
sure.
The totality of the circumstances, I can't, as a legal or as a use force expert, I can't really make a decision on that. But in regards to the de-escalation training, we also call it non-escalation training because it is how you talk to people to begin with that can prevent it from escalating. And then if it escalates, then we de-escalate. But there's so many important things to learn that are fairly simple, but police officers have a tendency to want to rush in and solve the problem, quickly. But I think some of the most important things that we train have to do with some simple tactics for knowing how to talk to people, because knowing how to talk to people in common sense, in my opinion, are the best skills a police officer can have. So if I would imagine myself going up and, chatting with somebody that needs to be removed from somewhere, I'm not going to tell them they need to leave. I'm going to ask them to leave. But as soon as I ask somebody something, they're thinking, wait a minute, what's going on here? Why do I have to leave? So I'm going to take my time and I'm, you know, sir, you know, I'm going to have to ask you to leave. And the reason is, and then explain the policies and go through that, answer their questions, take your time. If they're still not wanting to comply, then I'm going to present them options. You know, sir, I tell you what, you know, this right now, you know, if you leave, you know, it's not that big of a deal. From what I understand, they're going to work out some compensation with you. And, you know, I'm hoping that works for you. But if not, then, you know, you are going to have to be removed. And I don't want to have to do that. I don't want to have to remove you. I know you don't want that. I don't want to have to get physical. You know, right now we can take care of this, you know, very simply if you just would voluntarily get up and leave. But if you're not getting compliance, then it is time to act. And many times that may be to make an arrest. But in this particular situation, I'm thinking, you know, acting could be maybe then I go back to the airline personnel and say, can you guys consider some other options here? This person is not violent. They don't want to leave. And, you know, I'm not sure legally if it would even fall under trespassing, but because the person did have.
Right, they paid,
you know,
for the ticket.
It with, mm-hmm. Yeah, I paid right. for the, and they entered with, you know, legal authority. And so, and we just need to not get in a hurry, and we need to empathize with them.
Well, and it's also
angry.
Right, and we don't know if any of those conversations could have happened. They might have happened, and I also mm-hmm. wonder, Mike, about the tension already. Like, what happens with law enforcement when they walk into a situation that was already pretty tense? Right, people were already high strung. Nobody's in a good mood when they're traveling. I travel all the time, and it's very rare that everyone is in a good mood on an airplane, just to begin with, right? Even if everything goes well, people are not in a good mood. And I imagine in this situation, it was much worse because they had been sitting there and saying, okay, now, like, I feel like from what we understand from the story, you know, they were telling everybody the plane isn't leaving, people have to get off. And so when you're walking into an already tense situation, which I imagine happens often with law enforcement, what does the training say then about maybe sometimes do you feel like law enforcement officers have to walk into a tense situation and try to lower the tension in the room?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you continue with that professional tone of voice. You don't take anything personal. There's no reason for, even if they're yelling and cussing at you, they're not really mad at you. They're mad at the situation. There's no reason for me to get angry. There's no reason for me to jump to conclusions. I stay professional. I begin talking to the person. You know, I can see you're upset, sir. I get that. You know, I probably would be too. You know, and try to show some empathy and just continue to talk. But true professional police officers will take their time. They'll talk. They'll stay professional. They won't take things personal. And they'll work through some of these steps and some of these empathy phrases and try to work things out. But, you know, unless something gets violent just suddenly, there's no reason to get in a hurry and act. I mean, obviously,
right.
If the person jumped up and struck somebody or struck an officer or, you know, displayed a weapon or something like that, then it's time to act. But we just need to not get in a hurry. We need to talk to people. We need to explain things to them. And we need to do the best we can to work this out. And, you know, it can be a number of things if you get to the point where you do have to act. And, you know, that could just be simply saying, okay, sir, I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to go back and I'm going to talk to some airline personnel.
Right, and try to negotiate.
We're going to see if
you know,
we can
Mike,
work
can I ask you one other question about this, too? Because there's been so much made online about the fact that this was an older Asian man. It appears to me, at least from viewing the video, that police were of another race. And I know you and I have had a lot of conversations about training, especially for white police officers and what they should be knowledgeable about when dealing with people of another race. Is that something the officers should also always be thinking about?
Yeah, I think it's you know, it's there in today's world, but I think at the same time, if we follow our practices by, you know, through these non-escalation skills and de-escalation skills, we're basically treating everybody the same. And if you're treating somebody the same, but we also have to have an understanding that why people might feel the way they feel. And if they feel like maybe that this is being based on, you know, discrimination or bias or prejudice or something like that, let's keep that in mind too, because again, they're not mad at you. They're mad at the situation, and they understand all the crazy things that are going on involving, you know, policing today. But, you know, we send our recruits through so many scenarios and domestics and everything that people are yelling and screaming and officers walking in and staying professional, staying polite and talking to people and showing empathy. And by doing these things, that generally, most of the time, will resolve the problem, because most officers, when they go into these violent situations, they are able to talk to people and they are able to make an arrest without incident. That happens way more than the other.
But right, than what the situation we have now, where I'm just looking, apparently it looks like there's a news conference going on right now with Mr. Dow's attorney saying he's going to be suing the airlines. We just have about a minute left. Mark, very quickly, your column was about whether or not these officers should be allowed to carry guns like regular law enforcement. How far do you think this weekend's incident set back that argument for aviation police at O'Hare?
Well, what I wrote was that it set it back for the full 30 years since they started asking. It was pretty definitive over at the city council this week, there had been momentum for them actually getting the weapons, but that's all gone now. They can try again in a few years is what it's going to amount to.
Mark Brown is a columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times. As I mentioned, we'll tweet out his column he wrote about this incident, explaining a lot more about these aviation police officers. So we appreciate you doing that. I want to thank also Mike Schlosser. Michael's the director of the Police Training Institute at the University of Illinois. Gentlemen, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure.
Coming up, I'll be speaking with one of the former poet laureates of the United States, Natasha Trethewey. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Natasha Trethewey is a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet. She's also a former poet laureate of the United States and a Southerner. She was born to a white father and a black mother in Mississippi. Interracial marriage was still illegal when her parents got married. She started writing poetry in college. From 2012 to 2014, she served as the Poet Laureate of the United States. She's also the author of four collections of poetry and a creative nonfiction book about Hurricane Katrina. Her writing explores memory, race, and the lives of people forgotten by history. She's currently a professor of English and creative writing at Emory University. She's in Central Illinois and joins me in our Urbana studio because she's been paying a visit to the University of Illinois. Natasha, welcome to The 21st. Thank you so much for being here with me.
Thank you, Nyla.
When did you first start writing poetry?
Well, I wrote poetry like a lot of people as a kid. I think I wrote my first poems when I was in the third grade, and I had a third grade teacher and librarian who bound that collection of poems and put them in our library, and I felt very much like a poet. But I began writing poems seriously again in graduate school. I thought I was going to be a fiction writer when I went to graduate school, but I quickly learned that I was indeed a poet.
And so much of your poetry focuses on being interracial. And I wanted to ask you about your parents' marriage. So your parents got married, and it was actually illegal. They couldn't get married in Mississippi because they were an interracial couple.
That's right. I tend to write a lot about history. And certainly in writing about history and the history of the United States, race is there because race is woven into the very fabric of our country. And I write about it to the extent that it is American. But I do also investigate my own personal history, and some of that history is about my parents' interracial marriage being biracial. They met at Kentucky State College, which is one of the HBCUs, the historically black colleges and universities. My mother went there as a black woman from Mississippi. My father, who came down from Canada, went there because when he got out a guide to American colleges and universities, he discovered that it was one that he could afford without realizing that it was a black college. And he ended up there and met my mother. They first tried to get married in Frankfort, Kentucky, and were turned away. And they had to cross.
What year was this?
That was 1965.
Wow.
So they
not
crossed
long
the river.
Ago at
no,
all.
Not long. No, not when you think about it. When you think that we are now in 2017 about to celebrate the Loving versus the state of Virginia decision that finally ruled that those anti-miscegenation laws were unconstitutional.
So they had to cross the river, you were saying?
They crossed the Ohio River into Cincinnati and got married there.
And so when you were a child, were you aware of all of this? Was this something that was – I imagine it's not something that parents would probably discuss with their kids.
I had the kind of parents that would discuss it.
Okay.
And it's hard to live in Mississippi and not know what's going on because people glared at us, yelled things at us, burned a cross in the yard. Mm. It was easy to know at a very young age.
And how did they explain everything to you? How did they talk about it?
You know, I think that they said the kinds of things that I imagine a lot of parents in interracial marriages tell their children, that you have the best of both worlds. It's a very, you know, happy message of, you know, cultural blending and but they also were very open and honest about talking about racism in America and the kinds of things that we would face because we were a blended family.
How much of that you think is an important part of your poetry now? You mentioned something about American history.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's so much of Black history that I think is not taught as part of American history. I think we're learning so much more. As someone who grew up in the South, mm-hmm. I feel like there's a lot I didn't learn.
Mm-hmm.
As someone who had a Southern, and you know, growing up in Florida, there was a lot I did not learn about Florida and Florida's racist history until mm-hmm. I was an adult, actually living in the Midwest, and reading things like Isabel Wilkerson's, you know, The Great Might, reading things about, learning a lot about what it was like.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how much of, and I think so much of your work is about sort of providing that voice, providing a lens to people who are forgotten. How do you go about doing that?
Well, in my third collection, Native Guard, one of the things that I wrote about was the history of Black participation in the Civil War. The historian Eric Foner points out that of the hundreds of Civil War monuments, North and South, only a handful mention anything about Black soldiers, even as nearly 200,000 of them fought in the Civil War. Now, I am from the Mississippi Gulf Coast, a little town called Gulfport, and just off the coast of Gulfport is a fort called Fort Massachusetts, which is where the Louisiana Native Guards were stationed. The Louisiana Native Guards were among the first regiments of African-American Union soldiers mustered into service in the Civil War. And if you take the tour of the fort, as I did on the 4th of July, every year, there's no mention of the Black soldiers there. It was one of these histories that was sort of erased or forgotten or buried. And so I started trying to uncover and tell the story of those Black soldiers, which, of course, is an American story. It is deeply American. And now things have changed out on Ship Island. There's a plaque on the mainland before you go out there recognizing this history that belongs to all Americans.
So you said things have changed. How do you think – what role do you think poetry can play and help uncover this, right? Because it's interesting that you're in this realm as a poet. I think a lot of people would think, oh, this is what historians should do,
mm-hmm.
or this is what – and I think poetry is a form of education, but
mm-hmm.
I think people would think this is something teachers should be doing or historians should be
doing.
Well,
of course, professional historians are the ones who've been working on these issues forever. I mean, I turn to the work of professional historians in order to animate the characters I invent for poems. And yet, perhaps too few people read the interesting work of professional historians like I do.
Right.
But there is a way that poetry can reach a different kind of audience, just as all art can reach different kinds of audiences. And so the people who were working to get a monument erected, some kind of historical marker erected on the Gulf Coast, were thrilled and welcoming me to the struggle, in a sense, because of the attention that the book got as a book of poems. All of a sudden, more people know about it than might have known about it. And so we have to kind of pool the resources of historians and playwrights and poets and teachers to tell those stories.
I'm speaking with Natasha Trethewey. We're talking about her poetry. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, former poet laureate of the United States. And as you're talking about those characters, I wonder how, when you're sort of doing research, do you just put yourself in that world? How do you come up with these characters? Is it something where you're sort of imagining all of their lives and then you're writing poetry about them? Mm-hmm. What's that process like for you?
Well, I spend a good bit of time in the archives trying to read the letters that people who were stationed on the island would have kept, or reading diaries, reading newspaper accounts, traveling to the places to interact with the weather, with the climate, to imagine what their lives might have been like in a particular place. But I rely heavily on documentary evidence.
So I would love it. Would you mind reading something from this? Is your third book, Native Guard?
Mm-hmm. This is a poem about taking one of those journeys on the boat out to Ship Island. It has an epigraph from Alan Tate that reads, "Now that the salt of their blood stiffens the saltier oblivion of the sea." Elegy for the Native Guards. We leave Gulfport at noon, gulls overhead trailing the boat, streamers, noisy fanfare, all the way to Ship Island. What we see first is the fort, its roof of grass a lee, half reminder of the men who served there, a weathered monument to some of the dead. Inside we follow the ranger, hurried though we are to get to the beach. He tells of graves lost in the gulf, the island split in half when Hurricane Camille hit, shows us casemates, cannons, the store that sells souvenirs, tokens of history long buried. The Daughters of the Confederacy has placed a plaque here at the fort's entrance, each Confederate soldier's name raised hard in bronze. No names carved for the Native Guards, 2nd Regiment, Union men, Black Phalanx. What is monument to their legacy? All the grave markers, all the crude headstones, water lost. Now fish dart among their bones, and we listen for what the waves intone. Only the fort remains, near 40 feet high, round, unfinished, half open to the sky, the elements, wind, rain, God's deliberate eye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I feel like it's hard to follow that up with a question, but I did want to ask, how do you decide? Like, how do you decide which historical lives, or how do you decide which moments how to capture in a poem?
You know, the poet Mark Doty says, our metaphors go on ahead of us. So when I started writing about the Native Guards, I knew that I was just interested in this history that I hadn't known about, that hadn't been properly memorialized or inscribed on the landscape and the landscape of our cultural imagination. And at the same time, I was coming to the point in which I'd lived as many years with my mother as without her. She was killed when I was 19. And I began writing elegies for her, to try to remember her or even to bring her back in the way that the language of a poem can, if only for a brief moment. What I didn't know is what my mother had in common with those Black soldiers, and I found it out only because I was working on a poem called Graveyard Blues. I'd been jogging in the graveyard one morning near my house, and there's a Confederate part of the cemetery, and I couldn't get past each of the headstones without stopping to read their names. It was as if they were demanding to be remembered. So I went home and I thought, well, I'm going to write a poem about these Confederate soldiers. But what came out was a poem about the day we buried my mother. And the last two lines of the poem read, I wander now among names of the dead, my mother's name, stone pillow for my head. And the idea in those last lines is that if you were missing someone and grieving, you could go to the cemetery and lay your head on their stone and feel a kind of cold comfort in the hardness of the stone. And I knew that it was emotionally true when I wrote it, but it wasn't factually true. All those years, nearly 25 years later, I'd never put a stone on my mother's grave. She lay in the ground unmarked and unremembered, like those soldiers. And I realized that it had been my duty to remember her, just as it is our duty as Americans to remember and to memorialize and to erect monuments to these black soldiers who represent our history.
Do you feel like writing poetry, particularly as you're thinking about grieving the loss of your mother, do you feel like that's a – it sounds like that's another kind of comfort. You know, there's the cold comfort of the stone, but mm-hmm. I imagine there's a lot more warmth in the metaphor or the writing the memory.
Yeah, the poem – a poem is a sacred and living language. And so in poems, she lives again in ways that she doesn't in the actual world.
And so for you, do you feel like that continues to help with – I mean, because I'm – losing a parent, losing a mother is something that is – it's not something that you can get over, mm-hmm. right? So I wonder if this is a way that this helps you continue to grieve the loss?
I think so. I think that's sort of where I was going. I don't know that I finally got there with that idea of our metaphors going on ahead of us. You know, I tend to look outward in order to avoid a kind of navel gazing that, of course, any of us would want to do. But is there a way to do it while also looking out at the world? And so I still feel like my historical topics choose me. But what happens is they always reveal to me the deeper metaphor, the deeper thing. And so even when I'm writing about various historical characters and historical subjects, something always in there is about that loss that I live with constantly.
It's also, in a way, though, as we're talking about loss, it's about a loss we all have as Americans and not hearing these stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how you sort of see that loss play out. What's sort of the result of that collective memory loss in our country today?
That collective amnesia, that memory loss, is very dangerous because often you find a complete lack of awareness. You were talking about it earlier on, the things that we're not taught in school. And our own inner lives are starved because of that, and it threatens to damage our interactions between each other. When you see incidents of what my colleague Carol Anderson would call white rage, it often is predicated on a lot of history that has been buried that people don't know about. I feel like if people knew certain things about history, they wouldn't make the kinds of racist assumptions that they make. For example, one might be, well, you know, my people came here as immigrants. Why can't these people, meaning black people, for example, get themselves together? Why can't they do what my white ancestors did? And often, if they actually knew the history and how different the history was for some groups of people versus other groups of people, they might not think that. And we might instead know how much more we are alike as Americans without focusing all the time on how different we seem to be.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Natasha Trethewey, the poet. We're talking about poetry, about American history, about America today. And we're going to talk about that when we come back. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and you're listening to The 21st, and my guest is Natasha Trethewey, a former poet laureate of the United States. She's in Central Illinois right now to be at the University of Illinois. She had an event yesterday evening. We're speaking with her about her poetry, her work. Your father, Eric Trethewey, was also a poet. He passed away in 2014, I believe. Before his death, you had already written – we've been talking about elegies. You had already written one for him.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you do that?
Well, it's a very different kind of elegy. It's, you know, generally, of course, the elegy is to remember someone who's passed. But this is a poem that elegizes something else that's lost. And so it was a very difficult poem to write, but it was a poem that I had to write in order to communicate something deeply painful with my beloved father in the only language he would really listen to, and that's the language of poetry.
And what was his response when he read it?
He loved the poem, but I think he also was a bit in denial about what I was elegizing to. And instead, he said how lucky he was to get to see a beautiful elegy before he was gone. And so that means he was sort of overlooking the other thing that we'd lost that the poem is also trying to deal with. He also, you know, remarked that the poem made him look like less than an excellent fisherman. So that bothered him a little bit, too. But it's all true. He did not catch a fish that day.
I wonder if we could, if you would mind reading another poem about your father. This is Enlightenment. And your father, Canadian, I think it's such a fascinating, your father, a Canadian, as we've been talking about, you all standing in front of a portrait of Thomas Jefferson. Mm-hmm. Would you mind reading that?
Yes, sure. This is perhaps the hardest poem I ever had to write for my fourth collection. It's a poem that tries to examine the kind of deeply ingrained and often unexamined notions of racial difference that are manifest in the society at large, but even in the intimate relations within families, as with my beloved white father. Enlightenment. In the portrait of Jefferson that hangs at Monticello, he is rendered two-toned, his forehead white with illumination, a lit bulb, the rest of his face in shadow, darkened as if the artist meant to contrast his bright knowledge, its dark subtext. By 1805, when Jefferson sat for the portrait, he was already linked to an affair with his slave. Against a backdrop blue and ethereal, a wash of paint that seems to hold him in relief, Jefferson gazes out across the centuries, his lips fixed as if he's just uttered some final word. The first time I saw the painting, I listened as my father explained the contradictions, how Jefferson hated slavery, though, out of necessity, my father said, had to own slaves, that his moral philosophy meant he could not have fathered those children, would have been impossible, my father said. For years, we debated the distance between word and deed. I'd follow my father from book to book, gathering citations, listen as he named, like a field guide to Virginia, each flower and tree and bird, as if to prove a man's pursuit of knowledge is greater than his shortcomings, the limits of his vision. I did not know then the subtext of our story, that my father could imagine Jefferson's words made flesh in my flesh, the improvement of the blacks in body and mind in the first instance of their mixture with the whites, or that my father could believe he'd made me better. When I think of this now, I see how the past holds us captive, its beautiful ruin etched on the mind's eye, my young father, a rough outline of the old man he's become, needing to show me the better measure of his heart, an equation writ large at Monticello. That was years ago. Now we take in how much has changed, talk of Sally Hemings, someone asking, how white was she? Parsing the fractions as if to name what made her worthy of Jefferson's attentions, a near-white quadroon mistress, not a plain black slave. Imagine stepping back into the past, our guide tells us then, and I can't resist whispering to my father, this is where we split up. I'll head around to the back. When he laughs, I know he's grateful I've made a joke of it, this history that links us, white father, black daughter, even as it renders us other to each other.
That's Enlightenment by Natasha Trethewey, who's here with me. That's from Thrall, her most recently published work. She published that in 2012. I mean, as you listen to that, I can't, as you said, it was, I mean, it's very clear to understand why that was such a difficult thing for you to write. And I read, do you write everything? You write out your poems by hand?
I do.
And then, so that's sort of you draft out by hand?
Yeah, I spend several drafts handwritten long before I ever go to the computer and begin to sort of move things around. It's a whole different drafting process when I move from handwriting to typing it out.
And may I ask how many handwriting drafts did Enlightenment take?
Oh, my goodness. Enlightenment took a lot of drafts. I don't know exactly how many handwritten drafts, but after I typed it in the first time, then I'll print out the drafts as I work on them, and I handwrite on them the changes and the scratching out and all that. So, you know, I have a stack probably at least that thick, an inch
thick. And then you save all of them, right?
Yeah,
save
all of them.
Good. Okay. Wow. You know, there's so much in that, in Enlightenment. There's so much to discuss. But I wonder if I can just ask you about the South and our understanding of the South, mm-hmm. Outside of the, you know, outside of not, and I don't even mean Southern history, I even mean today.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you think that, if you think we have at all done an adequate job in this country of sort of understanding each other's regional pasts and histories.
Well, one of the things it seems to me, being a native Southerner and traveling outside of the South, is the ways in which the stereotypes about the South seem to hang on. There are so many ways that any Southerner, black or white, is bound to get defensive about the South because we're often, you know, portrayed as, you know, backwards and slow, and I mean, you know, the list of stereotypes go on. I'm sure your audience knows more than I even know, coming from the place. But I think what gets missed is the complexity of a place like the South, and particularly my home state, Mississippi. You know, my relationship with the South is the I think the only kind one can really have if you're a thoughtful person, and that is a love-hate relationship. There's plenty to hate about my South, but it's also my native land, and so I love it. Loving it means trying to make it better, and of course that is the most patriotic of acts, trying to make better the thing that you love.
Would you say that's probably true of, I would think, and I agree with you about the South. You know, I was telling you before we went on air, I didn't realize when you grew up in Florida, when you grew up in South Florida, you don't realize how Southern you are until you leave.
Mm-hmm.
And then I sort of realized the parts of my upbringing and my identity that were very Southern, mm-hmm. when I moved here to the Midwest. But do you think that probably most Americans have a sense of, if they are thoughtful about this country, have sort of a love-hate relationship, no matter – I don't know if you feel like in the South it, you're making a face. You don't think that they do.
Well, that's why I said, you know, the thing I said before about the most patriotic of acts is to, you know, have that kind of love-hate relationship and to try to make a place better. There are plenty of people, I think, who sadly think any criticism of the South or the United States is unpatriotic. And it seems to me that those are the people that unquestionably love or are patriotic about the nation without also being able to talk about its flaws and all the things we need to fix.
Well, it's fascinating you say this. I was just watching a news report last week about Confederate monuments,
mm-hmm.
and sort of the movement. And this has been a big issue in New Orleans,
mm-hmm.
With the mayor wanting to remove monuments. And it sounds exactly like what you're saying. People who say we don't want to remove these monuments because, well, they're just part of our history. And we need to, you know, we need to have – it's okay to have a monument to Jefferson Davis because this is part of our our history, and it doesn't mean, you know.
Well, I think the danger of removing monuments is not telling the full version of the story. We need to contextualize those monuments. You know, if you need to move them from a certain place, okay, put them over here, but put them with plaques that tell exactly why they were erected and what they mean. You know, monuments are doing different kinds of work. There are some monuments that were erected just, say in the 19th century or at a different moment when the thinking in the nation was one way. Then there are monuments that were erected specifically as a response to the civil rights movement, or the attempt to get equal rights for all of American citizens. Those are monuments that are meant to be in direct response, such as the Confederate flag in the state of Georgia. That's a flag that does not go back to the end of the Civil War, the one that we had that was so contested. It was one that was erected in direct response to Brown v. Board of Education. It was a message to African Americans.
There's so much of your work we haven't talked about. I'm thinking of Hurricane Katrina and all of that. As we're just about out of time, I did want to ask you, though, about do you have a hope of what you think people will take away from your poetry, from your writing, particularly if they're American?
My goal is always to tell a fuller version of our story as Americans. Not to erase one history in favor of another, not to look at them as two trains running on separate tracks, but to see how intertwined our stories are and how, in knowing our stories, we can continue the work to be the best nation that we can be, moving toward fulfilling the tenets of our Constitution.
I can't help but think, as you say this, of how much we've talked about in the past 9 months, in the past year, how divided we are as a country, how many parts of the country, whether it's rural or urban or southern or not, we don't understand each other. Do you think it's because we're not taking the time to try to understand that context, to hear these stories? Do you think it's a deeper problem?
I think it is hard to hear each other. It's hard because so much of our day-to-day language is the language of sound bites, cliches, the rise of uncivil discourse. And this is when I, have to turn back to poetry again and again, because poetry does ask for us to slow down a little bit. It also, it's the one way we have of reaching not only the intellect but also the heart. It asks us to be more thoughtful, more empathetic. It asks us to see the world through a lens, an intimate lens, of someone else, their voice speaking to us across the distances. That's a way that I think we hear each other. And I can say it even now that, some of the things that I say may sound incendiary to someone, but it's very different if you hear it in a poem. Because that is, the intimate nature of the soul trying to communicate with someone else's soul.
It's really another language.
It is another language. But it's one that I think can save us.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us, to talk to us about your poetry, to read some of it. Natasha Trethewey, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. And if you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us, whether you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media, it's all at our website, 21stshow.org. If you follow us on Twitter, search for 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. And when we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest Illinois news. If you like us on Facebook, search for The 21st. You can comment on what we're working on, or you can post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.